Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the next edition of the South African Sports Medicine Association podcast. I'm extremely lucky today to be hosting two really incredible and well-traveled sports physicians. The first is Dr. Louis Holtzhausen, who is a chief of sports medicine and sports medicine physician at the Aspetar Orthopedic and Sports Medicine Hospital, as well as an assistant professor of clinical medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College in Qatar. Louis is a former head of the Division of Sport and Exercise Medicine at the University of the Free State in South Africa, and he achieved his sports medicine degree from the University of Cape Town. He has more than 25 years of experience, including multiple World Cups, athletic events, rugby events, cricket events, as well as recently helping organize the Asian Cup. The second visitor that we have on our panel today is Dr. Celeste Geertsema, who is a New Zealand sports physician who was born in South Africa, who is currently working as well at Aspetar in Qatar. She has a fellowship with the Australasian College of Sport and Exercise Medicine, and she has more than 13 years of working with FIFA, as well in organizing other events like the IAAF, the FINA World Cups, the Handball World Championships, but most recently, she was assisting with the FIFA World Cup in Qatar. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you very much.
So let's get started. From a medical side, what does it take and what goes into organizing a major event?
Question. I'll start by saying that it's all in the planning. The whole event and the delivery of the service is a small part of it. It's really all in the planning. So what you need from a medical side and from any other side is time, because it takes a lot of time to put things in place. For instance, one has to do your homework and see what this particular event's history is, especially the injury profile history and so on, to know what you're up against. So you need to do some kind of a needs assessment, and very often data for past events are scarce, especially in the literature. People tend not to publish these things. One has to work out a budget. You've got to figure out what the logistics around the whole thing will be, where the venues will be, and so on. And of course, you've got to figure out a local referral network for medical issues. So there's a lot of pre-thinking and planning so you can understand what's going on. At the same time, you also need to understand the setup, because in these major events, Kyle, it's a massive undertaking with different domains, things such as security and media and protocol and whatever. So a whole lot of different departments, and each of these people think that their domain is the most important. Usually medical loses out. So you've got to understand that you're a small cog in a very big wheel. And if you understand how this thing fits together, then it makes your life just so much easier. And of course, from knowing what's going on, then one needs to start doing a whole lot of dedicated and detailed planning, which I'm sure we'll get to. Celeste, what do you think?
Oh, I totally agree. I think it's an enormous project. And I can say that for the FIFA World Cup in Qatar, I joined the project 2 years out from the World Cup, but many of the people there had been going for close to a decade in organizing this. And of course, you have many stakeholders from all over the country involved, which is a fantastic opportunity to meet other medical people who are working in the same country as yours, but not necessarily in the same hospital. You have to have a dedicated team, and ideally on your team, you want to have people who have previous experience of these events, who can then bring that expertise and, well, sometimes very valuable experience they've learned the hard way to the table. But of course, it's a large part of this is also the training. So you might have a team who already know what they're doing, but the majority of the staff that you're going to be working with at the event have probably never worked at an event before. So there's the training, and my responsibility in the World Cup was to train the 3,500 doctors, nurses, paramedics, and sports staff. So that was in itself was a year and a half project. So yes, there's a lot of things you need to think about. And ideally, what you want to end up with is all these preparations that you've done You know, it's somehow you want to be able to document that, because that really is a legacy effect. And if you ever involved in another big tournament, you will have a lot of these things already at your fingertips. Lessons that you've learned, plans that you've made, blueprints and so on. And then you only need to adapt it for the next event.
Yeah, great. I mean, I think the big question in terms of organizing such a big event would be, how do you coordinate overall the high quality of care from the multiple countries and their medical teams participating at that event?
I think the most important thing is communication, and early communication with the medical teams that will be coming your way. There are a whole lot of things. Different teams have different expectations. Some of the bigger teams have full medical support staff with them, with a lot of equipment and whatever consumables, drugs and so on that they want to bring with them. Others have nothing. So one needs to figure out what each and every participant needs when they arrive here. So early communication with the various stakeholders, I think, is a key thing. And then there are a few specific things, and I'm very sure Celeste can add detail, but one needs to make sure that everybody that comes here to try and, well, to be a team physician needs to be licensed to at least be allowed to treat his or her athletes at this event. And then logistical and legal and customs things like travel with medication, especially scheduled medications and things, got to get prior approval from the Ministry of Public Health in the case of Qatar. And one needs to take into consideration, for instance, local laws. Commonly used medication like codeine is, for instance, banned here by us. So it's not so easy to travel with your codeine-filled painkillers and so on. A nice way to make it easy for the medical staff coming your way is to put everything in a medical manual, so that there's a quick reference to who to contact, how things work, what the referral systems are like, and so on. So put it in writing, and then when the people arrive, meet with them, introduce them to the local conditions, and just remind them. But even more importantly, if resources allow, and this is what we do with the international events, is we get the medical, at least the chief medical officers of each team in a few months before the event, and we do a workshop and an information session with all of them, so that we are familiar with each other and that they know what to expect when they get here. So communication from early on, even if it's with email, but in best case scenario, even with personal visits and workshopping with the whole team beforehand. What do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think there's no other way you can do it but to reach out and make personal contact. And actually, the sports medicine field is quite small, as you probably all know. So even though it might be a massive event, you'll find that the group of medics are actually quite small. So it's not so difficult to make contact with them. And then it also depends on the kind of event that you're dealing with. So in the World Cup, we were very lucky. Of course, you've got these big football teams who are arriving, and a lot of their medical support are some of the best guys in sports medicine in their countries. So the quality of medical services are actually pretty good, and we're not going to try and dictate to them what they should be doing. In fact, quite the opposite. We need to be very aware of the fact that team doctors retain autonomy. Even if you are providing the medical services in your country, they are coming to treat their own players in your country, and they have the right to do that. They have total autonomy and final say when it comes to decisions regarding the players, even with touchy subjects such as concussion, for example. But what we did in the World Cup is we set up a model clinic for them, a players clinic, and every clinic in the tournament, all 118 of them, were kitted out in the same way, down to the last drawer and what's in that drawer and where is it placed and so on. And we showed them this clinic and we said, this is what it's going to look like. Every stadium in the tournament will be the same. You can give some input to see something else you think we should put in there. And we then made the modifications and sent out the inventory to them. So by the time they arrived, they knew exactly what to expect. And in fact, some of them said they could leave some of their bags behind now because they know what they're going to get in Qatar. So if you can do something like that, it's absolutely fantastic. But of course, that's not going to be the case for, say, the Olympic Games. where you might be providing full medical services for a lot of athletes who don't have medical staff with them. So then it's a completely different system. And there you can actually control the quality because you are the one providing the medical services. And then I guess the other thing to say is also, as you've touched on it, Louis, is that you've got to think about the local laws in the country where you're working. So I remember in the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, none of the doctors, even though they were licensed, they couldn't prescribe any medication. So we had to set up a system whereby a team doctor can liaise with a local doctor to write the prescription that they can then take and use for their athletes. So and every country will have a different thing. So you really need to know the local laws you're dealing with and how you fit into that. But again, it comes down to communication, essentially.
Yeah. Maybe I can add here, since we're talking about what we experience in Qatar, but not all countries are as fortunate as us and have a lot of resources. So if you guys are going to do medical cover for an event in South Africa, the resources are certain not to be as available as it is yet. So this what we're talking about now is the sort of plan A, but you can get away with much less and without having local site visits and things. Communication by email or by Teams or a Zoom meeting goes a very long way. So one doesn't have to spend money on getting the same thing done.
Yeah,
I mean, I think, as you say, communication is key. And the earlier that's done, the better the quality of care will be all around. Yeah, so the next thing I thought is, you touched on South Africa, is, so Celeste, just for our viewers to hear, so you were the first female team physician at a FIFA World Cup, which was in South Africa in 2010. What were some of the challenges you faced in South Africa, and what lessons, let's say, did you take from that to other tournaments that you've been part of thereafter?
That's a good question. I actually have to clarify that in South Africa, I was a team doctor. And then at the next tournaments, I was always working on the FIFA side. So I was a venue medical officer or general medical officer. And I actually learned some really valuable lessons in South Africa as a team doctor to help me in delivering these events in future tournaments, because I could see what team doctors needed. And what they mostly needed was support to get into the country with whatever they needed to bring with them. And that goes to what Louis was talking about, the communication in advance, to know what is it that they will need, what is available, what are the local medical services like. I mean, I'm South African, so I had a fairly good idea, but even then I wanted to know, if we're going to be in one venue, what is the local hospital like? What are the services that they offer there? Can they do x-rays? Can they do MRI scans? That kind of thing. So I learned that is probably the most important thing team doctors want to know, is this in the support when they're there, and they want to trust the local services. And I think it doesn't matter how good your local services are, if you do not communicate with the team doctors and show them what you've got and address their questions, they will never trust you. And that's when they will arrive with this enormous bag full of medications and life-saving equipment, because they think they're going to have to do it all on their own. So that was a very valuable lesson for me. And then I guess also the message that team doctors have final say about what happens with their patients. You know, we're so used to referring somebody to a hospital, and then the moment you refer them into the hospital, they take over the care of the management of that person or the player. But in a tournament, it doesn't work like that. You go, and as a team doctor, you are the one who still has to make the decisions, and they are there just there to support you. And of course, if you're on the other side of the coin, that's the service you need to provide. And sometimes it takes a little bit of self-control not to want to jump in there and make decisions and not to get upset with what people are doing, because it's not actually, if you're the organizer, that's not your remit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for both of you, I mean, what were the big challenges as well faced in, I would say, more extreme conditions, like in Qatar for the World Cup or for just Winter Olympic Games? What are the type of challenges you face in those environments?
I'm going to take this, because I tell you what, the biggest challenge in event medical management that I've encountered ever, and I don't think there are many other people who have ever done this, is I was the venue medical officer for the marathons and the race walks of the Athletics World Championships in 2009 here in Doha. And it was hosted in September, which is sort of towards the end of summer. And what we were expecting, and that's just the way it happened according to the, when they changed the international athletics calendar and so on, as much as they could, but this is as far as they could push it out. So we ended up still being in very hot, humid conditions with WBGT levels at black flag almost every day that the people competed. So technically speaking, I had to stop the World Championship marathon, which is something that's just not done. So one has to preempt and plan for a disaster. That's essentially what I was up against. And that's what we had to do. So for me, that was the biggest challenge I've ever experienced in terms of this. And I can maybe tell you how we went about it. And that's a good principle maybe for everyone listening, is that always prepare for the worst case scenario. Then the rest will be easy. And we did our homework and we saw that previous international marathon races, the highest number of people ending up in a medical facility was 20% of the field. So we expected then that 20% of our field will end up needing help. And mostly so because of extreme heat and humidity. So things like exertional heat, stroke and heat exhaustion and stuff like that, and possible cardiac arrest. So we were planning for really disastrous marathons and race walks. So the 20% meant that we had a field in the biggest of the marathons was 100 entrants. So we had to prepare 20 beds in our medical facility. And of that, we expected about a quarter of them to be heat-related and seriously so. So we had a 4 or 5-bed ICU with highly specialized cooling facilities and ICU facilities at the venue medical tent, which wasn't really a tent. It was a building in the end. But so that was my challenge. And we can talk about that at length.
Yeah, I think so. Just very briefly, it's interesting because you were talking about the heat, and of course, in Pyeongchang in the Winter Olympics, we had exactly the opposite. It was minus 20 degrees outside, and we had to. It's amazing how you have to go through the fine details. So when you're planning something, an event in any kind of extreme environment, you have to think about every step of the way what could potentially happen. Down to things like, how do you get somebody off a slope? And we're talking here about the Olympic downhill slope, which is so steep that you only the best skiers can even ski across it. And it's completely icy because this is what they do for speed. So you've got to imagine trying to rescue somebody from that slope. How do you do it? And things like, how do you prevent the saline bags from freezing? And so you've got to go through the whole scenario. And this kind of brings me a little bit by what we did in the FIFA World Cup. Unfortunately, of course, we didn't have an issue with weather, cold or hot for that matter. But we did go through that process of thinking of the worst. And I'm sure that you'd be aware of some of the cardiac arrests that have happened on football pitches. And this is obviously the worst thing that could potentially happen in a major tournament. And so FIFA had developed this emergency action plan, which is a scripted response to a serious emergency on the pitch. And we actually spent a year training how to do this action plan. So you have two field of play teams and each person has a role and who's going to do what role in that scenario. So that they could, and they practiced so many times that by the end, they probably could do it in their sleep. Hopefully not. I mean, I don't want them to be awake, but it really brought home this principle of anticipating the worst, planning, going through the finest details and then practice until you've got it down so easy that so well that you almost don't have to think about how you're going to do this.
Yeah, I mean, now that you mention it, I think my question, I mean, maybe you can just mention a few of the techniques. So, what did you put into position, for example, like preventing the freezing of your fluids, preventing for, let's say, your medicines expiring or getting damaged due to the extreme heat conditions?
Yeah, so, for each one of those problems, there will be an individual solution. So the fluids, for example, there are certain heating mechanisms and heating bags that you can use. But the thing is that you need to think about it and make sure that you get them in advance and that you have it in place. And you guys did some, what did you do for your medications in the...
Well, we had just about an equipped pharmacy in there with fridges for the medications. Mm. Yes. But regardless of the medications and that, we also had to keep the people cool. So when we had to have lots and lots of ice, the only thing that can cool people really down is ice. Mm. So we had cool trucks, you know, like these lorries that bring the frozen food to the shops. Lorries like that full of ice for us to use in ice bags and in our ice baths and things like that. So, and that takes a lot of logistics to get a truckload full of ice in the middle of, well, towards the end of summer in Doha. And but we just had to insist on that.
And maybe the other thing I could also mention here, Kyle, is that one of the things, so this is not just for football, this is for any major event. You should have checklists. And we have checklists before every match. So, of course, we have the checklists before the tournament starts. And usually for me, the rough mnemonic is PIC. So it's people, equipment, processes, and policies. Those are the four main things. And then almost everything else fits under that. And you would have that before a tournament starts, but then you also have that on every day. So if you arrive at a stadium, you will make sure that you have all your stuff in place and you have to have redundancy in the system. And I'm a firm believer in, well, checklists and buddy systems when it comes to these events. So you should always have somebody who can stand in at the last minute if somebody is sick or is an absence. Then equipment. We literally check every piece of equipment, especially electrical equipment, before every match. So you would switch it on, make sure that it's working because the battery might have run out. And equipment, unless we have a very robust system, we will check the expiry dates every day, unless you have a way of logging when you use things. And then processes. We have meetings before the match starts, or and even in the IAAF, we have the same thing. Every day you will have a pre-match briefing where you go through what will be the processes in specific situations, how your referrals pathway is going to work, who's going to respond to what part of the pitch, all of that. And then communication is a very important one. So we do radio checks. We make sure that everybody knows how to use the radio. We make sure that everybody's on the right channel. And then policies. And this is where you take the opportunity to remind people about the do's and don'ts, because sometimes you have staff that come in only for that day or only certain days. And so you need to do this whole thing over and over again every day. And maybe it gets a little bit boring for people, but by the end of it, people know exactly what they should be doing. And you know, the last, in a football tournament at least, and also in some of the big track and field, the last matches are always the most important ones because they are the finals. And you don't want new people coming in and only then learning about things. So if you've done this process, if you've done your checklist every match day, by the time you get to the final match, everybody knows exactly what they're doing. So, and this is also with expiry dates and things like that. You should be able to pick things up as you go along and replace them.
Maybe I can also add to this. You've been now talking about your match day drill and the meeting beforehand and briefing of the staff and checking your equipment. But to me, an even more important meeting is the debriefing. Yes. Afterwards, to see what went well and to give accolades where it's due, because people want to be appreciated and that makes them come back with a smile tomorrow, but also to be brutally honest about what didn't go well and then not to be critical about it, but to be able to improve on it the next day. Mm-hmm. So the debrief is often the thing that people neglect, but I think that is that's a sort of golden opportunity for improvement and for creating trust.
Mm. I agree with that. I think maybe now is also a good time to then just mention that if you're living and working in a multicultural society like we do here in Doha, it's very important when you have these meetings to consider the different personality types, the different cultural backgrounds, the different communication, way of communicating that people have, so that you need to do it in such a way that you pitch it just right, so that people appreciate your feedback and at the same time they're enthusiastic about coming back and you don't step on any toes. And I'm not saying that based on you. I'm saying that because I've stepped on toes before. We are being very South African and very honest about something. And then I realize that I should have maybe pitched it a little bit differently. So it's important to think about these things when you have these meetings.
So this is so important. And Robin, I can tell you, we from South Africa, we are very aware living in the Middle East that we are sort of a very low context type of people. And we say things directly, we say them as they are, especially me being an Afrikaans guy and also being rather, you know, sort of big in stature. Physically, I mean, it's very difficult to scare people who are sort of soft-spoken and from higher context societies where the spoken word is not really the way to communicate, but rather the body language speaks. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to scare people and to offend them if you are me with a loud South African accent and being a big person. So I have to be very careful how I get across. Otherwise, the thing comes out totally wrong. Yeah, that's a really important thing.
One of the things we learned early on when we arrived in Doha is that you have some people who are traffic light people and some who are roundabouts. And I think the majority of South African people are probably traffic lights. And then in my experience, a lot of other cultures are roundabouts. You need to say things in a roundabout way. But yeah.
So while we're talking about understanding and communication, the one thing that often gets neglected, and this is important because in South Africa it's even more important, is language. For instance, again, there's a, I think in our hospital, they speak more than 50 languages. So this is truly multicultural. But the one person that we admitted to hospital from our athletics marathon events spoke a language, an African language from, I don't remember, one of these small Northern African countries that nobody could understand, not even the other Africans around. So she ended up in the hospital with nobody being able to communicate with her. And that was a problem. So language and preempting language barriers and having a network of translators or interpreters, even if it's just on the telephone line, I think it's a very important thing to think about.
Yes, and I think that the other thing that goes with that is a medical support service. Often you'll be working in an event where that already exists. So in the World Cup, for example, we have team services. They are the people who are there solely to support the teams. And so you won't even speak to the team. You'll speak to the team support services person who would then communicate with the team. So there it's very well set up, and that person can always speak English and the team's language. But then, as you say, if you come to some of the other events, especially where there are lots of athletes from smaller countries, maybe there's only one athlete in the team and they don't have medical support with them. If they then get admitted or they need to be treated, it's really important to have somebody who can help you support this person, because it's horrible, I think, if you are an athlete in a foreign country and you end up in hospital and you're completely on your own. So to be able to have somebody there to help them through that whole process without having to send one of your medical staff, because the medical staff are valuable in these tournaments, that's really important. And it's challenging because, of course, that takes a lot of staff.
Well, you think how horrible it is for the doctor not understanding what's wrong with this patient.
Yes.
Because, for instance, this one that I'm talking about was admitted for possible encephalopathy. So we didn't know if this person was confused or whether it was just a language thing.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult thing to figure out. Yes.
And I mean, I think that's a challenge we have on a daily basis, even in our own countries, of if you're unsure, if you're unable to speak their language, your diagnosis can be extremely difficult if you don't have the correct support.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So I think that we spoke a little bit about previous experience really is beneficial in providing quality care at these events. But I mean, I'd give you both a chance, but what advice would you give to young or inexperienced sport and exercise physicians in preparing for a big event or games, as well as traveling across the world with so many athletes?
I think the best advice for somebody wanting to do event medical care is to equip yourself, first of all. And the only way to really do it is to go out there and put yourself out there and volunteer, even if it's at a school athletics competition or whatever, or a rugby tournament or what. Put yourself out there as a volunteer and learn from none other than the paramedics, the ambulance personnel, the paramedics, especially in South Africa, are really good at what they do. And we can learn so much from them as medical doctors that, you know, people don't realize that. So go out there and work with them to see how it works. They know the ins and outs of these events. And obviously then see how you can align yourself to work under supervision of people who've been there before. For us who've been around the block, it's really a nice thing for us to get people, to draw them in and to show them the ropes. So it's enjoyable for us as experienced people, but it's also nice for a young person to learn so that you don't reinvent the wheel when you get there. So that would be the thing that I would advise young people getting in. So just get yourself out there in some way or other and learn from everybody.
I completely agree with that. And I think the one thing we don't often talk about is if you follow a medical career and it's going to be in a hospital or in a clinic, there's usually a well set out path. You can just, you go down that path and there's certain things that are expected from you and you know what you need to do. With event medicine, it's still a little bit different. Here it's about opportunities, grabbing opportunities when they come along and doors opening for you where you didn't even expect a door to be. And the only way you can use that is if you're on the spot. So you might end up going to one event, you meet people there who are organizing another event, and you've had this experience of this event, you've learned something, and then they ask you to come to the next event and so on. So it's about being in the right place at the right time and then grabbing every opportunity that comes along and making sure that you take something home from every event that you've been to. And whether you were there as a volunteer, and we just talked about this, support services for the athletes. That's not actually as a doctor necessarily, but medical support service. So that's where it's a good place to start. And then as you get further along and you start developing, you become part of the medical team. And then the other thing that I think is also really important, which is something I've learned the hard way, is from the beginning to start working on your processes, your checklists. How do you pack your bags? What are the things that you always check? What are the communication? Who should you talk to? All of those things that eventually when you become an organizer of a major event, these things will be second nature. You wouldn't even have to sit and think hard, what are the things I need to think about? Because you've been developing this over the years whilst you were part of these events. So it would be my best advice. But grab every opportunity you get. Small or big, just go for it.
So yes, but also, Carl, I think, asked about advice for traveling doctors.
Yes.
You've got a lot to say about that, I know.
Well, I've traveled a lot. The thing is, I worked for the New Zealand football team for 7 years. And the nice thing about football is that you travel all over the world because every country in the world just about plays football. And when you live in New Zealand, you travel a long way. It's not short distances. So I really had to get super organized with traveling. And there's a lot of things to think about when you travel. You see the visas and things are taken care of, but how do you get your medications into the country? What do you take to the country? How do you pack your bags? And I realized that one of the best ways to do this is to try and build up a network in each country where you're going to be traveling to. It's not always possible, of course, but if you know where you're going, see if you can find somebody in that country that you know or that knows somebody that who can introduce you. And try and figure out what is available there. And then you know, have a much better idea whether you can trust the medical system, what you should take with you. And then just, as I said, have those systems in place where you have your little checklists, you have a routine way of doing things. And it makes it much, much easier. You don't have to reinvent the wheel every time you go. So, yeah, that would be my main advice for that. And you learn a lot about sleep deprivation, jet lag, travel fatigue. And it's really important. If you can build up a good relationship with a coach, you can actually influence performance by advising, for example, when is a good time to train when people are jet lagged. You know, when is a good time for them to do fitness training? When is a good time for them to do skills training? Because their brain works differently depending on how much, what time of the day it is and what the jet lag profile looks like. So you can actually contribute a lot, but you need to read about these things. You need to learn about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that brings us back again to one of the first points we made about communication, is if you communicate and have a good relationship with your team, it really benefits our athletes immensely.
For sure, for sure. I think it's absolutely key. I think we've said it for how many times now? Communication is the most important thing. And working as a team, being part of that team, not just offering a service, but actually being part of the whole process.
100%. Well, guys, thank you to the both of you for your time and for being part of this panel discussion. I think it's such an important concept in sport and exercise medicine, and something which is extremely complex, needs obviously experience, but something which lots of people can get involved in, as you say, even if it's volunteer work or supervised with someone who's experienced it before. So I thank you for your time, and hopefully we'll see you at the upcoming SASMA conference in October.
Oh, I'd love to come, yes.
Thank you. You'll definitely see me around. I'm going to drag some this with.
That's great.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Carl. We've really enjoyed it. And as you can tell, we're quite enthusiastic about this topic. So I really hope that we've stimulated some enthusiasm in your listeners as well.
Thank you very much.